Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal, Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we bring you exciting new guests to talk about various aspects of UFOs and the paranormal. And the hot topic now is UFOs. This is a field that I think we're going to see a lot of changes in the future, and certainly there's a lot of information out there that people, I think, would be very interested to learn about. And tonight we have a very esteemed guest in this field. His name is Stanton Friedman. He's one of the leading UFO researchers in the United States and the world. He's been doing this forever. He's appeared on countless radio shows and talk shows, including Larry King Live, on which he's been a guest many times. He's written several books, UFO Crash at Corona. His latest is Flying Saucers and Science. And he's also due to be a speaker in the upcoming UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada. So we're very, very honored to have him on our show tonight to talk about some of his most recent research, his latest book, and what he's going to be talking about at the UFO Congress. So, Stanton, thank you so much for coming on to the show again.
It's my pleasure. I'll feel warm in California.
Oh, yeah, the weather's nice here. Not like, you said it was, how many inches of snow you got last night?
We had 15 inches of snow last night. And
well,
recently we set a record for how cold it got. The record was first set in 1884, and it got down to 34 below zero the other day. New record!
Wow. How can we still be setting records in this day and age? Jeez.
Well, it's easy. You just hang around long enough, I guess.
I guess so.
Global warming, you know, that's what it is.
Right. Well, certainly we've heard a lot about that. Even the ETs talk about that.
Really?
So your book, Flying Saucers and Science, that's your latest one, right?
Yeah. Excuse me, I'm working on a new one, but still waiting for a go-ahead from the publisher, I'm pretty confident. But, and that'll have a different title. It's impossible, isn't it? That all the stupid things that smart people have said that have stood in the way of progress in medical fields and space technology and aviation and all kinds of things. No shortage of examples. You know, space travel is utter bilge, said the British Astronomer Royal a year before the first satellite went up.
I remember when, well, I don't remember, I wasn't there, but when Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, someone, an esteemed person, said, it's a nice invention, Mr. Bell, but who would ever want one?
Well, who would want to look at a box with pictures on it all the time? The reaction to television.
Yeah, it's amazing how much ignorance is impeding our progress. I think that's just typical with this whole UFO field in numerous ways.
Yeah. Well, there's a new issue of the Skeptical Inquirer out. And, you know, this is the skeptics organization, one of the two skeptics organizations, and they're vying with each other to who can say the stupidest things. And this new issue illustrates, you know, the basic rules for anti-ufology. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. And do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too much trouble, and nobody will know the difference anyway.
Right. Well, when I see you on Larry King battling these skeptics, I mean, I have to laugh. I can't believe people take these skeptics seriously with these, you know, the things that are coming out of their mouth.
Well, you know, I've had a lot of response to, and they reran that last King show I was on last July. They reran it New Year's Eve. And there was Bill Nye, the science guy, whose whole purpose in life is to deny. I mean, anywhere I had a lot of people say, I don't understand guys like that, he said, but maybe they ought to have them on more often. It makes the good guys like you look good.
It really does.
Sort of a perverse way of looking at things, but it was strange. And, you know, he was on the first and second half of the show, and his attacks on the military guys Malmstrom Air Force Base, and another case with Robert Hastings, who did a nice job, were just incredible. You know, all 10 Minuteman missiles went down. Maybe they just had a power failure. You know, they got triply redundant power, of course, at a missile launch place where you got nuclear-tipped missiles waiting to be launched. And there are other things like that that you just sit back and say, well, where did that come from?
Right.
And he explained away, in an earlier show, he'd explained away Roswell as a skyhook balloon. And I tried to talk to him about it this last time on Larry King. That's the way it is. And walked away. Except there had been no skyhook balloons launched at the time of Roswell. And those were huge polyethylene balloons, capable of lifting a high payload to about 100,000 feet. That was their purpose. And nobody has ever talked about huge polyethylene balloons. Even the Air Force wasn't stupid enough to say that. They said Mogul balloon, at least that was standard conventional balloons. I mean, 25 of them or so, linked at 20-foot intervals, but not a huge polyethylene balloon.
Denton, I can't hear you. Yeah. I think we may
you
have
can't
a
hear me.
Connection.
You can't hear me?
If anyone out there is still listening, if you can just hold on for a second, we'll try and get things back to normal. Having some sleep. Everyone, welcome back to UFOs and the Paranormal. We had a slight technical difficulty, but we appear to have it solved. Sorry about that. But you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal. I'm your host, Preston Bennett, and our guest tonight is longtime pioneering UFO researcher Stanton Friedman, author of the new book, Flying Saucers and Science, original Roswell researcher, and just all-around great guy. So I think, Stan, sorry about that interruption there.
But oh, well, it happens. Maybe it's the noisy negativists interrupting us, huh? Don't forget last year's book. The book in 2007 was Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience.
Right, Captured.
By myself and Kathleen Marden, who's Betty's niece. And she's going to co-author with me on this new book, providing the publisher comes through. It's impossible, isn't it? She has strong medical interests, and she'll deal with the number of... You know, it's hard to believe it, but there were many people who died because there was opposition to the notion of vaccination. I mean,
wow.
To illustrate, you know, we're not just talking casual, well, those guys weren't too smart or anything like that. We're talking about people dying because of resistance from the guys on top. And that's discouraging. It's sad. We're not talking just one or two accidents. We're talking lots of people. And so there's a point to all of this. We need to be very wary of the people who do their research by proclamation because they've done a lot of damage in the past. And we'll probably continue to do so unless some of us stand up to be counted and say, hey, wait a minute, let's get the facts straight here. Well, a good example of that in this new issue of Skeptical Inquirer, Dr. Joseph Nickel does an overview on Roswell, and as might be expected from his past proclamations, gets just about everything wrong. And you wonder sometimes, where does this stuff come from? For example, he says the press release was put out by an inexperienced PR man without authorization. Now, that's nonsense. Walter Haut was the PR man for the 509, the most elite military group in the entire world. They dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, two more in Operation Crossroads in the Pacific in 1946. This has all been published, of course. There's no surprise there. But, of course, he never mentions that. And Walter also flew more than 20 flights as a bombardier over Japan during the war. He was chosen to drop the instrument package over, within or over, on one of those two atom bomb blasts in the Pacific. Right. Inexperienced. He wasn't ancient like me, but gee, not inexperienced. And the notion that a PR man for the 509th would put out a release without Colonel Blanchard's permission is absurd. I mean, he'd have been in the brig as fast as you could say Jack Robinson. It makes no sense. But that's one of many things he gets wrong. And one of them really irks me because there were two articles that came out in the Roswell paper. One was on July 8th, based on Walter Haut's press release, which went all over the country. I mean, it was in the Chicago Daily News and the Los Angeles Herald Express and in the Sacramento Bee and the Spokane Chronicle and, you know, a whole slew of newspapers.
Everywhere.
And one of the key things that it said was that the wreckage was found last week. Okay. The rancher had come into town on the 6th of July, a Sunday, and gone to the sheriff's office. The sheriff called the base. Jesse Marcel at the base talked to the rancher, talked to his boss, Colonel Marcel, and went out following the rancher back to his ranch because there was no way to tell anybody how to get there. It was out in the middle of nowhere, off the road. With Colonel, or later Colonel Cabot, he was Captain Cabot then, it was the base counterintelligence guy. Okay, these were on strict instructions from headquarters to go out there, you understand.
Right.
And yet, what people forget and what Joe ignores, even though it's been published many times, that was on the 6th that they went out. They came back late on the 7th. The article went out on the 8th, while Jesse was sent to Fort Worth, Texas with some of this wreckage. Now, Colonel Blanchard must have been stupid not to identify a couple of balloons, except that the rancher had recovered balloons that Jesse Marcel was familiar with, radar reflectors and weather balloons. He'd had a course that dealt with those, and right. Blanchard well, just happened to send
son,
him
actually,
off.
I had Jesse Marcel's junior on the show, and
Colonel Marcel,
and
Dr. Marcel.
Jesse Marcel Sr. had quite a resume. I mean, an unbelievable resume. There's no way he would mistake a balloon.
Well, that's right, and certainly not Colonel Blanchard. They'd both been over in the Pacific during the war. Blanchard, they were with the group that dropped the atomic bombs. These weren't dinks, you know, and Blanchard went on to be a four-star general. He was vice chief of staff of the Air Force. Of course, none of this appears in Joe Nickel's article. You know, it's quite incredible that they ignore the fact that the rancher was brought back into town and fed a news story. He was seen in town by friends who said he didn't talk to them. He was with two military guys. And we heard it from his son. He was fed a news story to tell. And this is where Nickel and all the debunkers come from. They look at that second article, just a bundle of sticks and rubber and stuff that would be just a couple feet square. Now, think about that for a minute. If that's all there had been, and Jesse Marcel said the field was three-quarters of a mile long and a few hundred feet wide, But if all there was this little bundle of sticks and stuff, the rancher would have brought it into town and gone home. There'd have been no need for Jesse and Cabot to go out there. The reason they went out is because the rancher said there's loads of this stuff out there, and I'm concerned about my sheep. Who's going to clean up this mess? Because sheep will eat anything. They get hungry.
Stanton, here's the question. Why are there so many intelligent people out there who still refuse to examine this evidence, who will not believe? I mean, it's almost as if they got an 8A, 6A. They're just not going to even consider Roswell.
Well, I think you're right because, I suppose, I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm just a physicist. And we don't get into the world of the mind very much. But when it comes to motivation, you know, there are a lot of things that happen. I mean, somebody the other day, didn't he kill 5 kids and his wife and himself because he lost his job?
Right.
I don't understand people like that, you know. But I think when it comes to UFOs, here we have people who are making a good living. Dr. Joan Nickel is the chief scientific investigator for the Committee for Scientific Inquiry. You realize his scientific credentials are that he has 3 degrees in English. English, which isn't a science as far as I know, but...
No,
you know,
I don't think so.
In addition, he has another bit of great experience. He's worked as a magician for years. And I guess that qualifies him for demonstrating that he can fool people. You know, he can disinform people. Isn't that what magicians do when you get down to it? They mislead, misrepresent. That's their stock and trade. But remember, they've staked so much weight on there being no UFOs that they would have to admit how far wrong they are. What would happen to contributions to SICOP? Well, it used to be SICOP. Now it's just Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, CSI. Notice those initials. And the new issue of Skeptical Inquiry comes out every couple of months. Scientists look at the UFO question. Except the people they have listed aren't scientists. Now, inside, there's a whole list of prominent scientists who waved the flag for the Committee for Scientific Inquiry, but they don't do any of the investigations. They leave that to the peons. I mean,
well, I have to wonder if these professional skeptics aren't being paid. I mean, your research, for instance, into Donald Menzel, I mean, my God. You have to wonder where are the people coming from, right?
Well, yeah, and that does raise a serious question about that. And, you know, it's interesting that the original Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, which became a Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, when they were part of the Humanist Association, a major contribution was made to them by a guy named Corliss Lamont. He was a very wealthy guy. He also was brought before the House Un-American Activities Committee and was considered a fellow traveler. Fancy way of saying a communist sympathizer back then. Now, I'm not getting into the politics of this, but it is interesting indeed that the two areas that they've been attacking the most are UFOs and paranormal phenomena, you know, remote viewing, all that stuff. And these are the two areas that have the biggest military implications. And so if you can make enough noise to keep people away from these subjects, that would be a benefit to our opponents. And now some people say, boy, he's really reaching on that. Well, you know what? Muammar Gaddafi, head of Libya, you know,
right.
He doesn't travel very often, but he was in, I think it was Vienna, when he made a comment to a reporter that he was supporting the anti-nuclear movement in the United States. And you say, what in the world is that all about? And then you realize, wait a minute now. If you can support the people who can slow down the building of nuclear power plants and therefore increase the cost considerably, maybe people will burn more oil. So it makes sense when you get around to it, you know. And
yeah.
So here are these skeptics who have a nice headquarters, a whole bunch of people on staff. If you look inside the magazine, it lists them all and stuff. And so I would call it self-preservation, but you may have hit it right on the head. They may be being paid by somebody. It's certainly not by the scientific community in the sense that nothing that they do justifies the notion that they're using scientific techniques about UFOs. And I'm going to do my next column. I do a monthly column for the MUFON Journal and for UFO Magazine. Right. And it'll be about the noisy negativists and what's wrong with their arguments. And I'll never run out of material if I just talk about that. But let me get to some news. I was intrigued with a piece of news that I picked up in the last couple of days.
What's
the
that?
The government of Denmark has opened up its UFO files. More than 30,000 reports were released so the public can get at them. Now, Denmark isn't that big a country, and I'm a little surprised at how many reports they had. The press release said reports of extraterrestrial craft. Now, I don't know whether that's a bad translation or whatever, but it is encouraging to see that. And also, Miles, who was it the other day? No, it was a guy on Bill Hemmer on Fox was talking to Nick Pope from England.
Mm-hmm.
And Nick was saying that orders had been put out to shoot them down, talking about UFOs. And if you could see the look on Hemmer's face, what? You know, he was totally shocked by this. And, you know, I could have told these guys, hey, read Frank Fascino's book, the Shoot Them Down. I wrote the foreword and the epilogue for it. It's listed on my website. But the point is, he goes into details about 1952. There were orders given. This is according to the Air Force, mind you. Orders given to military interceptor pilots to shoot down UFOs if they don't land when instructed to do so. Now, I don't know how you tell a UFO pilot to get the heck down there, buddy. But, but anyway, that article appeared in a number of papers, but not in the Washington Post or the New York Times. And another article that didn't appear in those two was a statement from an Air Force two-star general saying, we've scrambled jets after UFOs hundreds of times. And, of course, they're no threat to the security of the United States. We keep hearing that. So why are you scrambling jets and telling them to shoot them down? You know? So there's a real world out there, and the debunkers aren't in it. I mean, the data's there, whether it's in England with Nick Pope, who, of course, was at the UFO desk at the Ministry of Defense for a few years back, a decade ago. The Fox guy was so shocked. You know, are they hostile? Well, we don't know, kind of thing. But so, you know, things are happening, and when it gets on Fox Network, and you could see the face, it was funny. And there, of course, the Congress now, it's coming up February 22nd, I guess, through the 27th, and or 28th, I don't know. I'm speaking there, and my topic will be, surprise, surprise, Flying Saucers and Science, the title of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I will have to do something I don't normally do. I have to give a PowerPoint presentation, not slides. I'm being dragged reluctantly into the 21st century. But I'll be there, and I'll be signing books and talking to people and meeting with people. And, you know, they're expecting well over 600 people there. This is in Laughlin at the Aquarius Casino. And all my upcoming dates are listed on my website at www.stantonfriedman.com. And there's another one. I'm doing something I've never done before. For an old guy, that's kind of unusual. But I'll be appearing at a science fiction conference. Despite what I say in my book about science fiction writers who attack UFOs without knowing what they're talking about.
They
you know,
do.
People like Isaac Asimov and Ben Bova and Arthur C. Clarke.
Right.
They've said some dumb things about flying saucers. That's going to be in Memphis in March. And then I'm doing something else I've never done before. I'm going to be with a tour put together by the Elder Hostel Group. They just take seniors around on buses and visiting interesting places. And for the first time, they're doing a tour of New Mexico. which will include a visit to Roswell for 2 days, and I'll also go along with them to see the Trinity site where the first nuclear weapon was exploded, and we'll see the White Sands Dunes, one of the largest areas like that in the United States, and we'll visit Hangar 84 in Roswell and the International UFO Museum and Research Center, and you know, and I'll be sort of I'm not the official guide. I'll be shepherding the flock and giving two lectures to about the 20 people who will be there. There's still a few places left, but now that's something I've never done before. It might be fun.
All right.
But, of course, I'll be at Roswell on July 2nd through the 6th. I don't know what I'm going to talk about there. Probably something connected with Roswell. Why not? And I'll be at MUFON in Denver, Mutual UFO Network 40th Annual Symposium. And you'll like the title on that one there. Of course, you have to prepare a paper, too. The Pseudoscience of Anti-Ufology. And they deserve it, boy. Is it pseudoscientific? It's, you know, great confidence in taking a viewpoint that turns out not to be justified by the data. That's pseudoscience.
I'm trying to think of any other field of science where they bring on so-called experts to attack your research. It's just, it's kind of unique to this whole UFO field, if you know what I mean.
It seems like that, although I guess the Bigfoot guys and the ghost guys get a lot of this stuff, too. UFOs are the most popular targets to attack, and Roswell ranks number one, it's clear. Because, you know, getting back to your original question, if Roswell really happened, as I'm convinced the evidence is overwhelming that it did, then that solves the whole UFO problem, doesn't it? It proves two very important things. Aliens are visiting, and the government knows all about it. And these are things that the debunkers have been denying for decades. You know, so it's to their best interest not to accept reality. Attack, and, you know, I notice in one of these articles in the new issue of the Skeptical Inquirer, they even explain away, go back to an old explanation for Kenneth Arnold's sighting. It was mirages of something going through the mountains. Dr. Bruce Maccabee, an optical physicist who knows about mirages, which are an optical phenomena after all, has easily debunked that. Nothing fits, you know, the direction, the angle above the horizon, all this kind of stuff. But don't let the facts get in the way of a good, quote, explanation, you know. So, and I'm excited about something else. I'll give an early warning on your program. Scott Ramsey and his wife Suzanne have been working on the Aztec UFO crash for several years. This is Aztec, New Mexico, March 1948.
Sure.
Not too long after Roswell. And everybody's debunked that case, but Scott has dug out witnesses who were there, all kinds of evidence, and demolished the arguments of the noisy negativists. Oh, a certain road wasn't there at that time. Well, if you go down to the map company in Albuquerque and get a new map of the old ways, oh, that road was there and been there for 50 years before that.
Wow.
And you couldn't have carried something big out of there. So Scott has an expert who worked for a company that their big thing was arranging to move huge things across the country. I mean, really big, heavy, monstrous things. And he had him spend a week down there looking at how the roads were in a situation, and could they have moved it in 1948 to, say, Los Alamos? And it turns out, his opinion is very definitely they could have. And so, I'm waiting. His book should be out, I hope, in maybe 2 months about the Aztec UFO crash. But it's solid research.
He's writing a book?
Yeah, it's almost done, not quite. But it's almost done, and you ought to have him on once he gets it done, because Scott is got an engineering background, and he and Suzanne have made many visits out there, tracked down loads of people, and dealt with, faced up squarely to the attacks of the debunkers. And none of them stand up. And they all sound good to get the data, you know. So these are exciting things happening, and, you know, I'm going to be in Illinois. That's right. Not close to you, but Galena, Illinois, at the end of May. And McMinnville, Oregon, that's not far from you.
No.
May the 13th, 14th, 15th, I think. It's listed on the website, www.stantonfriedman.com. You know, that's where the pictures were taken in 1950.
Sure, Paul Trent.
The McMinnville photographs and by Paul Trent, right? And Bruce Maccabee has published scientific articles about them. And so this is the 10th anniversary celebration. I mean, it took place in 1950, but they've been having this Congress for 10 years. And I got a kick when I was the keynote speaker. I had the privilege of sitting in a rumble seat, first time in my life, in a 1932 Ford, beautifully appointed, leading a parade. I was the parade marshal, waving from the rumble seat. It was fun. And, you know, these things aren't just dull papers and stuff. I will be giving a paper. I hope not too dull. But it's fun for the kids and for the town. And, you know, it gives people a chance to learn without it being too painful. You know what I mean? Fun with.
So, let me just take a short station break here. Everyone, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Bennett, and our guest tonight is longtime pioneering UFO researcher Stanton Friedman, who's having a very profound effect on this field as an original Roswell researcher, producer of several books about UFOs, and all-around speaker on all kinds of radio and TV shows and conferences. So, well, you're quite a busy man, going all over the United States and the world, huh?
Well, I've spoken in all 50 states in 9 of 10 Canadian provinces and in 16 other countries, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I get around.
So,
here's
the question I wanted to ask you. Roswell is the case that will not die. I think it's going to be the case that busts this whole field wide open one day. And there's always new information coming out, and I picked up this book. I don't know if you know about it. It's edited by Lawrence R. Spencer, and it's called Alien Interview, and it's based on documents provided by a nurse called Matilda O'Donnell McElroy, who claims to have been at Roswell and was in the Jeep with Sheridan Cavett, taken to the Roswell site, and communicated telepathically with the E.T.
Well, the last I heard, the author admitted that this was a fiction book. I'm sorry about that.
Ah, okay, so you have heard about that.
I have heard about it, and of course I was disappointed, but at least glad that the guy admitted it instead of trying to defend something that couldn't be defended.
Right.
What can I say? I'm sorry, Brett.
No, that's all right. I mean, that's what makes this, you know, Roswell case so interesting. It's been 50 years more, and it's still not dead. I mean, this case is really the biggest case, I think, in the world. And I have high hopes I think I mentioned this to you before, that we're going to see this Roswell craft in a museum someday.
Well, wouldn't that be nice? And incidentally, the research isn't dead. I have been in touch with a guy who's got somebody, I won't mention any names, who lived in New Mexico at the time and knows a lot about the case and hasn't really ever spoken out before, and he's trying to arrange for that person to talk to me, and I'm willing, of course, and so I'm waiting to hear back from him with bated breath because, you know, we're racing the Undertaker and we normally lose.
Right.
But you do what you can, and it's anybody listening, who knows anything, who happens to have a piece of wreckage left by a grandfather umpteen years ago, look at my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. It gives my phone number, my email address. I'll give out my email address. I won't give out the phone number because then people start calling and it bugs up the phone when we're talking or I'm trying to listen. But my email address, very straightforward, FS for Flying Saucer, Frank Sinatra if you want, PHYS for Physicist, at Rogers, R-O-G-E-R-S, .com. So FS, PHYS, Rogers.com. And my toll-free number is given on the website, and I really do want to hear from anybody who knows something. Your witness names won't be used without permission. There's no point in it, because if people think their name's going to be spread out all over, they're not going to come forward. So there is still a chance for those who know something, maybe second generation, to let the rest of us know and to have their information protected. As a matter of fact, at last year's Roswell conference, there was a new witness. He was 82. And he'd been located by Don Schmidt and Tom Carey years ago. Refused to say anything. He was in the yearbook, see, the base yearbook, so we know he was there at the time. And finally, his granddaughter convinced him that maybe he ought to talk. So he came forward, and they brought him to Roswell. I was on a panel with him. He died 2 months later.
Wow.
He wasn't in good health. I'm not making anything conspirational about that. But and he was out in the field picking up pieces of this strange foil-like material. He'd crumble them up, put them in a burlap bag, and they would open up before they got to the bottom of the bag. He came across very well, even though he was 82. And I'm sure there are other people like that out there. So if you want to have a try, have somebody look at my website, get my toll-free number, and give me a call. I should tell people I'm in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, which is 73 miles east of Houlton, Maine. I'm in the Atlantic time zone, 4 hours ahead of you, Preston, would you believe? And people say, what do you mean 4 hours? It's only three to the East Coast. I said, yeah, I'm past that. Time zone changes at the boundary between Maine and New Brunswick. But we really, you know, and there's another area in which if people know anything, I'd like to hear from. I mentioned the Shoot Them Down before, 1952.
Right.
Well, over the years, I've heard 7 different stories of pilots going up after UFOs and not coming back.
Right.
And so it appears that the aliens were responding in kind when we were getting pretty nasty. And, of course, the government doesn't want to talk about that either, but there must be people out there who were aware of such events, ground crew, you know, radar operators, etc. And I'd sure like to hear from them, too. I might as well not go to your grave with such important information. And I'm hoping people will take the attitude. One of the key witnesses on Roswell was retired General Thomas Jefferson Dubose. He was the chief of staff to General Roger Ramey and is in those pictures taken in Ramey's office in Fort Worth, Texas. And I managed to locate him, and I met with him twice. He lived in Florida. He's no longer with us. But in our last conversation, he said, Stan, if I remember anything more, I'll tell you. He was 86 at the time, I think. What can they do to me now? So people who are listening, think about that for a minute. If you're in your upper 80s, what can the government do to you now?
Roswell witnesses now are not being harassed by the military, are they, in any way?
Well, not so far as we can tell. Jesse hasn't been told to shut up. You had him on the air.
Right.
His book, incidentally, is Roswell Legacy, and it's a good book. I wrote the foreword for it by Jesse and his wife, Linda. And if you want the story straight from somebody who handled wreckage and who has had a distinguished career, he's a medical doctor. He was a colonel serving in Iraq 2 years ago. They called him back in at age 68. Flew 225 combat hours in helicopters. He's a flight surgeon as well as a medic, so to speak, and a colonel. I mean, this is a distinguished American, and his book is well worth reading because this is straight from the horse's mouth. You know, what his dad told him, what he saw, and you don't get many books like that. I mean, the rancher's son hasn't written a book, and he's gone. So it's an unusual opportunity to get the straight scoop, and, you know, I wish people would go to the fact types instead of the SICOP or the CSI types.
Right. What do you think of Roswell witness Frank Kaufman?
The late Frank Kaufman was somebody who lied his way through the whole story. And Don Schmidt and Kevin Randall have admitted this. They had believed him. I mean, they didn't contribute to the lying. But after he died, Don and Mark Rodiger, head of the Center for UFO Studies, visited with Frank's granddaughter. I was at his home, too, and found documents that he had fumbled with trying to make up phony documents. And so they have completely renounced his testimony. And it's a shame. And I've spent time at his home, and I've spent time with him, and there was no basis for the claims he was made. And one of the things that I got a real kick out of, Frank was an artist, a good one.
Right.
And I saw paintings at his home, and he drew a picture, supposedly, of what this thing looked like, you know? And I just, by accident, going through some old magazines that I had, the cover of a Popular Mechanics article about 1990 had the drawing from which his drawing was made. It had a picture from which his drawing was made. That's what it looked like? No, that's what the TR-3B looked like.
Well, I should mention to everyone that there's some 300 other witnesses to Roswell, or I don't know how many at last count, but at least that many, right? Who are
well, I don't know. I haven't tried to count them. Way back in when I first talked to Jesse's father, Jesse Marcel Sr., Major Marcel, I first talked to him in 1978. By 1980, Bill Moore and I had found 62 witnesses, and this is before the internet, you know, so it was hard, slogging work, telephone information, Christmas address books, you know, all that sort of stuff. By 1986, we had found 92 witnesses, and Tom Carey and Don Schmidt and Kevin Randall have found a whole bunch more, so it's a big number. Now, you'll get people saying, well, Kent Jeffrey, used to be a pilot for Delta Airlines. Well, I talked to some B-29 pilots from the base, and they didn't know anything about it. And I talked to some people, he said, from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and they didn't know anything about it. And he never had security clearance. He doesn't seem to understand two things. One, there would be no reason for the pilots on the base who weren't involved to be told about it. Need to know is the operant thing. It doesn't make you a better B-29 pilot to know that a crash flying saucer was recovered. And secondly, Kent didn't have a clearance. So they wouldn't have told them even if they did know. And the same goes for the guys at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. They weren't there at the time, 47. They were there much later. And if they had known, they wouldn't have told Kent without a clearance. And I should add that I talked to the man who, General Exxon, we had lunch together, so I talked to him in person, and he was commander of the base in the mid-60s. And he told me that he didn't have a need to know as commander for everything that went on the base. Guys came in to track down a UFO case. He had to arrange an airplane for them. But he didn't get copies of their report. He didn't have a need to know for that, or for a lot of other intelligence work. And so Kent didn't understand that. And so the notion that absence of evidence is evidence for absence is nonsense. You know, of course he didn't get data from people who probably didn't have it to begin with.
He was the guy behind the Roswell Declaration, is that right?
Yes. He got, I forget how many thousand, 10 or 20,000 signatures, and then he turned around fully the other way, and he said, it isn't a security problem, it's a, it's, what did he call it, a political problem or something like that. How anybody can say that the recovery of a crash-flying saucer, where the saucers have capabilities certainly well beyond what we had in 1947, wasn't a national security problem, I don't understand. Everybody on the planet would love to be able to duplicate the flight behavior. And, you know, there's another thing that relates to that. There are a number of people who are pushing, well, these are really secret German aircraft. They'd worked on them during the war, and they were brought over to the United States or to Antarctica or pick a place, Argentina. I've heard of three declared. They're of earthly origin. And I keep saying, if we are making these, we earthlings, some of us are making these, how come they weren't used in any of the many wars that have been held since 1947? You know, who else has money enough to spend to develop high-performance vehicles other than the military? And if you develop them, you use them. Boy, we could have used them in Korea, couldn't we? And in Vietnam? And in the Gulf War? And Gulf War II? And so forth? So, you know, I defy anybody to tell me that they've been developed here, but nobody wants to use them. What is the point of that? We developed a stealth aircraft, $10 billion in 10 years. It wasn't a cheap project. We used it. Of course we used it.
I've heard some people say that parts of the stealth were actually, you know, reverse engineered from, you know, crashed UFOs, some of the technology.
Well, we might have had, I'm not saying we didn't learn something from the wreckage. And certainly one of the things you learn is that, gee whiz, look at that, you can make right-angle turns. I wonder how you did that. It sets you wondering. And, you know, knowing that something you're trying to accomplish can be accomplished is a big step toward getting it done. Because if the first one doesn't work, you keep trying. A good example of that, Hitler had a small nuclear weapons program going with some outstanding scientists, I might add. But he didn't know you could build an atomic bomb. He did know you could build rockets, so he spent far more on a rocket program. The Russians, on the other hand, after the war, knew you could build an atomic bomb. We'd set off five of them. They were smart as we are, so they would keep at it. And so, you know, there are a lot of things that, well, in my book, Flying Saucers and Science, there's a picture of me with my hand on the Apollo 12 command module. It was taken at North American Rockwell Downey operation in Southern California. And NASA asked me to talk to their people. They didn't allow the North American guys into the talk. I don't know why. But they went around and took my picture, gave me a tour and all this sort of thing. And the interesting thing is, when I was young, a long time ago, everybody thought that a high-performance airplane had anything moving really fast in the atmosphere had to have a pointy nose and sharp wings. Remember the X-15?
Sure.
But the Apollo command module was a round, blunt body. And one wonders whether somebody, we know they ran wind tunnel tests in the late 1947 on disc-shaped craft, whether somebody didn't run some experiments because they knew that these darn flying saucers were moving at high speed in the atmosphere. How do they do that? Well, that might have been the genesis for the idea. But I'll tell you, standing next to that thing really struck me. It looks far more like a flying saucer than a high-speed aircraft.
Wow. Interesting. So in your research, I imagine a lot of people contact you. Do you hear other stories about UFO crashes other than Roswell?
Well, Yes and no. And, of course, I've spoken at the Aztec Symposium in the past a couple of times, four times, I think. But you hear of others, too. There are some in Russia. On the other hand, you don't hear a lot of solid stuff. Now, Len Stringfield put together a list of, I think it was 60-some stories of supposed crashed saucers. And but Len was a collector of stories, not an investigator, and he protected his sources, so he wouldn't let anybody else follow up on them. So I don't know how many of those are legitimate. You know, things come down from the sky all the time. And there were a couple of instances where Len wanted to go public with stuff, and we said, check it out first, Len, please. Well, he didn't, and then he came away with egg on his face. It turned out a picture he was making a big deal out of was a phony that had been published in one of these crummy magazines out of New York. And a couple of the others, they just didn't prove out. I mean, if somebody tells you he was a ranking officer somewhere at some time, he should be able to demonstrate that with his DD-214 form of discharge papers, because they give assignments and so forth. Right. So if a guy can't prove he was there, you better be very careful about accepting what he says about what happened. You know, the records aren't totally complete about everything you ever did in the military, but they're good enough so that if you're saying you were in charge, you know, it's like Colonel Corso said he was base commander over at Holloman. No, he wasn't.
Really?
No, he wasn't. The record is clear. He also said he was a member of the National Security Council. In a sworn statement, he said that. Well, when you check with the Eisenhower Library, not only was he not a member, but he never attended a meeting. Oh, he was a liaison with certain groups for the NSC, but he wasn't a member of the NSC. He's right at the top of the heights of control of very important stuff, military stuff for the government. So, you know, because you're a bat boy doesn't mean you're the star pitcher for the baseball team, you know?
Well, that certainly casts dispersions on his story a little bit.
Yeah, I would say so, quite a bit. But that's the kind of thing you have to do, is check out the claims. And that applies in both directions. If you're going to believe somebody, I mean, I know Jesse Marcel Sr. was the base intelligence officer because his picture and name and rank are in the base yearbook. That's an easy, quick way to verify it, you know. Don't tell me he wasn't there, you know. And the same goes with some of the other people mentioned. General Dubose retired. I met with him in his home, but I know he was there. He's in the pictures taken in General Ramey's office. So, you know, nobody can deny that he was there and involved, and, you know. So you have to be real careful. I'm not saying there haven't been other crashes, but you got to have good, solid evidence. And let me correct one of the wrong pieces of acceptance, that governments can't cover things up. They've been doing that very well for a very long time. You know, the Manhattan Project developed nuclear weapons, 60,000 people, $2 billion in 1942 money, was kept secret for several years. Many other instances, there's a whole chapter about the Cosmic Watergate in my book, Flying Saucers and Science. And when I go through a number of programs where billions of dollars were spent in secret, but the secret not coming out for decades, not a year or two, decades. And so anybody who says governments can't keep secrets just doesn't understand. That's usually people who've never had to keep secrets. Of course, there is a problem. There are some people with big egos who are in Washington. If this were true, I would know about it because I was an important person. That's the attitude. And boy, does that help government keep secrets, you know.
Right, right. Well, Roswell certainly hasn't been kept a secret, but, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with Congressman late Congressman Stephen Schiff's efforts to get any kind of verification. I mean, what's it going to take?
Well, you know, there's an interesting part of that story, incidentally, with regard to the MJ-12 documents. And I know some people will tell you, Friedman's the only nut who thinks those things are real. They're obviously frauds. Well, There's over 100 of them that are fraudulent, but it's the four key ones that I say are real. And anyway, one of the arguments against the Cutler-Twining memo from the noisy negativists is that, look, it says top secret restricted. There are statements from two different government agencies saying that wasn't used in 1954. Well, the people at the GAO, and the names changed to General Accounting Office and then Government something or other, it's like a government investigative office anyway. And I talked to one of their people again just last week. In a report that they wrote, said that they were at a particular facility looking for documents because of Congressman Schiff connected with Roswell. And they had the place that they were at had documents cleared, classified up through top secret, and so over the right time frame. And they said they didn't find anything having to do with Roswell. However, we noted several instances of the use of top secret restricted, even though we had been told, Majestic 12 in quotes, that it was not in use at that time. So if the GAO says that, that's good enough for me.
It's good enough for me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, where else can you... Incidentally, I did try to get copies of those documents. They were still classified. And so I couldn't get them. These guys had clearances for everything, but I don't have clearance for anything these days, so... Too bad, Stan.
Well, this cover-up can't go on forever. I mean, with Denmark and, you know, Mexico released that UFO footage a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Remember with the infrared stuff? And
Belgium's released some stuff. And Chile's releasing some stuff. Spain's released some stuff. The French and the British have released some stuff. And Project 1947, to their, and I give them praise for it, they've been going through old Blue Book files and finding more and more good cases that were passed off, you know, dismissed as, oh, it must have been a balloon. And then when you look more carefully, oh, it couldn't have been a balloon, you know.
Right.
And they're compiling these, and more power to them.
Wow. Very interesting. Well, Stan, our time is pretty much up. I want to thank you so much for coming on to the show. You're a great guest, as always, and doing really, really important work, and I'm just so happy you're out there doing it.
Well, I am going to continue as long as I can, and don't forget www.stantonfriedman.com. You'll enjoy my article on government UFO lies.
All right. Well, I guess that's our show for tonight. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you. Good night.
All right, everyone, that is our show for tonight. I want to thank you for listening. You've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and our guest tonight has been longtime pioneering UFO researcher Stanton Friedman. Check out his new book, Flying Saucers and Science. He's also speaking at the UFO Congress in Laughlin shortly, and you can visit his website, www.stantonfriedman.com. Thank you all for listening. I hope you can join us next week when we bring on another exciting guest to talk about UFOs and the paranormal on BBS Radio. Until then, have a wonderful night and a great week. Bye now.